This is a Hat Trick podcast.
Oh, lovely.
The Coldest Shift. Episode 2. Quarantine.
We quarantined at two different times, so the ship's crew quarantined a week early. So about 30 plus people, plus all of the FIDs. So FIDs is an affectionate term for people going south. And I think it stands for the Falkland Island Dependents. They're the scientists, the electricians, the plumbers, whatever. They're the people going to the base.
You've got to remember that most people will live near where they were brought up and do jobs which were predicated by their upbringing or something like that. So it's quite a big leap of faith to go, shall I go to Reading and do IT? Or shall I fly to the other end of the world over winter and be deployed for 20 months? I think I'll do the latter.
We went to the BAFTA one of these days of the first aid course, and I was just talking around the table. I don't know any of these people, so they're all new, but they're all very interesting. And I said, oh, you know, what are you going to be doing when we go down south? And she said, oh, I'm a marine diver. And I thought, oh, great, brilliant. Well, you know, what do you do? And she said, I dive under the water, I collect starfish, I bring them up, I cut them in half, I weigh them, and then I burn them, and then I compare their dry weight to their wet weight to work out their carbohydrates. I've never not had a question because I was so flabbergasted that that was a job.
It's absolutely insane. You know, there isn't the option to go for time out and a spa. A lot of the time, there's not the opportunity to go for a nice bracing walk. Also, they've got this thing over winter, they turn the lights out. So whatever your job is down there, it is bonkers to go and do it.
But we all consider ourselves relatively normal people that just have a passion for what we do. You know, you speak to somebody who climbs mountains and crosses polar regions and they think it's the most normal thing ever. And you're just like, wow.
One of the first people I met, I actually met him in Plymouth. And I remember at the time I had to sort out his shoulder and make sure that he was safe enough to go. And I sort of said, oh, you know, what are you doing in the field? And he's like, well, I'm digging up these ice cores. And I was like, oh, right, OK. And I took him to the station. I came back and spoke to a colleague and I said, oh, what do they do with the ice cores? And he went, you know, the ice cores that worked out that the world's warming up. I went, oh, those ice cores. When I was down south last time, guys were coming in from the field and there was the head of magic, which is one of my favourite job titles that we have. It was one of the projects was called Magic. Those guys were coming in out of the field. They were studying the melting of the huge glaciers. There were people studying the geology beneath it. There were people studying the water underneath the glaciers. I've been over to Halley and seen the bit that someone years ago decided to shove a thing that looked at the ozone. And so it's just a simple bit of kit that sat staring upwards. And that was the kit that went, oh, hello, there's not quite enough ozone up there. And these are things which are changing the world as we know it.
Well, I'm sorry I can't be there to help you pick curtains.
I will send you what I was looking at, actually.
There are people in my life that I would call maybe two or three times a day. And the idea of not being able to call them two or three times a day was a little bit scary, but equally quite relieving, Jen, I would say.
Yeah, it was certainly for me. I think when you're in your hotel room, it ramped up to possibly about four or five times a day.
This is remote curtain choosing.
I know! God, we're so middle-aged.
Yesterday we talked about mortgages. Today we're talking about curtains.
So exciting. Have you taken your sewing machine?
No, of course I haven't taken a sewing machine. I'll go to the Antarctic, you plum.
That's totally what I would do. I'd take my sewing machine and I'd get them to ship that back.
I've had a very busy morning. Would you like to hear about it?
Yeah, go on.
So I got woken up by breakfast at 7 a.m, as usual.
So rude.
I then managed to close my eyes for another hour and a half.
Yeah.
Before being let on hour release for exercise.
Perfect.
Ran 4.1 kilometres and Strava tells me I'm a local hero.
My God!
Yeah.
You're so busy!
So I'm out for my daily run. An hour's exercise a day. So every day, try to set a good example as the doctor. Head out, big smile on my face. Legs like lead. And the problem, not only how unfit I am, there's 85 people doing the same thing throughout the day. So the paths are muddy, slippery, and I'm constantly having to dodge people.
Pre-departure screening has been a major part of the work that BASMU, BAS and a lot of other nations do, and it's just making sure that everyone that goes down south is as well as they possibly can be, predicting any problems that would happen and, you know, getting everyone well.
Maybe I'll be tall, skinny and blonde by the end of this.
It was a big time when some nations required everyone to have a prophylactic appendicectomy, and there's a really lovely story of a famous Russian surgeon, Leonard Rozgov. This was back in the 60s, and he was on the ship Ob, and it was the 6th Soviet Antarctic expedition. They set off from Leningrad in 1960. The mission to set up a new polar base. They opened one in 1961, and I'm going to pronounce this wrong, Novolashchenitsa. And by the time they finished building it, the winter had descended. There was howling winds, there was freezing temperatures, and the sea ice came in with a full force. The ship had long gone, so they were well and truly destined to winter on their new base. Our Russian surgeon, he rapidly noticed that he became unwell in the early parts of 1961. And he describes in his journal this symptoms of weakness, malaise, feeling awful, nauseous, unable to eat anything. And his symptoms really progressed to getting a low-grade fever, so 37.5, 38. But he examines himself and describes this central tummy pain that then migrates to the right lower quadrant, which any doctor will tell you is fairly classical of appendicitis. And he wrote this really lovely thing in his diary. "It seems I have appendicitis. I'm keeping it quiet, even smiling. Why frighten my friends? Who could be of help? A polar explorer's only encounter with medicine is likely to be in a dentist chair." And I think he slowly realised that getting out of there was not an option. Nevertheless, he managed to grab himself a bit of a plan. He started himself on antibiotics. He gave himself fluids, antipyretics, bring his temperature down. And then there's one night he writes in his journal, "I did not sleep at all well last night. It hurts like the devil. A snowstorm whipping through my soul, wailing like 100 jackals. Still, no obvious symptoms that perforation is imminent." By perforation, he means the appendix bursting, which is potentially fatal and reasonably unpleasant. "An oppressive feeling of foreboding hangs over me. This is it. I have to think through the only possible way out, to operate on myself. It's impossible. Almost. But I just can't fold my arms and give up." What an incredible thing to say when you're on the crux of life itself and facing overwhelming sepsis and organ failure. Anyway, so he managed to get his team to get the room ready, the hospital there ready. They sterilised it, and his two right-hand men were the meteorologist and the mechanic. Before it happened, he told one of them what he should do if he should lose consciousness, which drugs to give, how to ventilate him. And he told his other colleague what instruments to hand him throughout the procedure. That concept is just incredible to get your head around, and it's something that we do for everyone going south. So a portion of the people going down south on the ship, on the stations, we'll train them up to be our right-hand man should something happen. And I don't think the real objective is if something happens to us. It's more if something happens and we need to go and do something else and go and see to other casualties. So back in the 60s, this Russian chap, he scrubbed himself, he positioned himself and got himself at a nice 30-degree angle so he could see what he needed. And he quite quickly realised that doing it with gloves was impossible. He took those gloves off so he could feel what he was doing, and it makes my toes curl. He used just 20 mils of 0.5% procaine and a mirror. He had to stop a couple of times, but he found the appendix that was horribly infected and managed to complete the operation on himself in an incredible 1 hour and 45 minutes, even stopping to ask his colleague to take pictures. There's a lovely part of his reflection on the whole thing when he says, "I looked over at them. They stood there in their surgical whites, whiter than white themselves. I was scared too."
The human mind is a constantly evolving lava lamp, isn't it? You can be quite scared about walking into a room with new people that you're going to meet. Going into a bar on your own can be a bit of an intimidating thing. But if you do it a few times, it suddenly becomes okay. If you think about Antarctica, when I first got there on my first trip, you have to have your tag on a thing and you move it to peg it to where you go so everybody knows where you are. And the first 24 hours, that's really, really important. It is incredible how quickly you forget that, and the risk that you see outside just drifts away.
Today is the first day that I've really been a bit bummed out that we're locked in a hotel room. I can't tell you where. I'm sure I got an email saying if you tell people where it is, we'll have to kill you.
I've had some complaints today that people's noses still hurt.
Still?
Yeah.
I had to go round and swab everyone about 7 million times. I am exaggerating a little bit, but when you're wearing full PPE, the gown, the mask, the gloves, the visor, the hat, you sweat profusely. And you know that swishing noise doctors make when they walk around corners? This was less swishy and more sticky.
Lovely.
It's a double-edged sword. One, I desperately, desperately, desperately don't want to catch anything from these people. So half of my time is spent thinking, if you've got something, I want to do my very best to not catch it. So I do my swab first, and then I put on 7 layers of PPE and I wash my hands 12 times. And I wear a visor and my glasses. The whole thing's very steamy and very sweaty. And that's before even swabbing anyone. And then I go from room to room, knocking on their door quite aggressively, because I've got to get all of this done within 2.5 hours, because that's when the courier arrives.
Uh-huh. Nice to see you. Bye.
To people that I've never met before, so they meet this very sweaty ginger person of which you can only see that much. You then ram a plastic tube up their nostrils, in their mouth, put it in a thing, and then move on to the next person. Then you have to wipe your hands and change everything. The first 10 people get nice, Rachel. The first 10 people get, oh, I'm so sorry that you're here. This isn't going to be too bad, blah, 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 blah. By the last 10 people, open your mouth. Here we go. I think what's really interesting for me is that Antarctica has no disease. There's not a contagious place to be. There's nothing you can catch there. There's no polar-specific disease, which is something that's baffling. And that I don't think there's a country in the world that you can go to where there's no disease specific to that land, which just makes it even more special than it already is.
The scale of everything is overwhelming. Overwhelming. Whilst it's devastatingly beautiful, it just looks hard. I remember there's a huge face of rock of a really high mountain up to the side, which had copper in it, so it was kind of verdigrised. But it was twice the size of a skyscraper. If you put that drama of the guys turning up in the Terra Nova or Shackleton's ridiculous antics to survive, that really does do your head in. And when the weather turns, we don't understand that up here. You suddenly feel so distant from everywhere and everything, and you feel very impermanent. You feel that Mother Nature might just get a bit cross and rub you out.
Within 97 geographical miles of the South Pole, we made many interesting geological and scientific discoveries and had many narrow escapes throughout the whole time.
Henry Gully wrote in 2002 a fabulous article into the Journal of Emergency Medicine where he managed to get a hold of a list of all the drugs that Shackleton took on his expedition to the South Pole, the one that had to turn back. And he wrote this book called The Heart of Antarctica. It's quite funny, the parallels of stuff that we take now compared to what they took then. So I'll just read you a couple of excerpts. So, one tube of laxative pills, one tube of boric acid. Now, boric acid is interesting. I think they used it probably as an antiseptic, but could have also been to preserve food. They took mercury. Back then, they thought it was to treat skin infections. So interesting thing to take. They took arsenic. And I think they thought that was going to be useful to treat things like malaria, syphilis, all those sorts of things. But I'm not entirely sure whether they used that or not, or what we would use it for, really. They took some eye wash, which is an unreasonable. What else did they take? They took some quinine, good treatment for fevers and malaria again. They took some adrenaline, which isn't unreasonable and something we definitely take for now. Useful for anaphylaxis or real life-threatening events. They took cocaine in vast quantities, judging by his book, which they pretty used an anaesthetic and also probably was useful for seasickness. Ginger essence. Now, that's an interesting one because I think there's been a real turn in medicine towards going back to plant-based medicines where we don't need to use pharmacologically made drugs anymore. And, you know, even back in the 1900s, they knew that ginger essence was good for seasickness, dyspepsia, problems in the gullet, that kind of stuff. And if you read his book, you'll find that he took a lot of opium and even offered it to his teammates when he knew that his trip was doomed.
Yo, yo, yo.
Hey.
Can you see me?
Just about. You're a bit dark.
What did keep me sane in quarantine was a load of my friends and family had written some good luck cards, farewell cards, and I'd have a glass of wine, you'd have a glass of wine, we'd call each other and open a card that day.
Every evening.
Every...
The daily event. That was just one of the many phone calls a day, just to be clear.
So
opening... not a very good one.
Opening a card a day has come to a brutal ending. There's only one card left.
I think it's going to be the best.
You reckon? Do you reckon it's going to make me cry?
Yeah.
I did save your card for the last day for lots of different reasons. Read into that what you will. It was actually because I was nervous that you might have said something rude in there.
Would I?
I think you did say something rude in there. Do you remember what you said, Jen?
It was in a nice way, though.
Oh my gosh, there's a lot of handwriting in here. Do you want me to read it out?
I can't even remember what I wrote.
With feeling
it's been
or?
So long.
To my favourite ginge. Exclamation mark. I know you will have the very best time and everyone on board with you will have a better expedition because you are there. Exclamation mark.
Have you got a single salty tear yet?
No, because I don't have a heart. Enjoy every second, take thousands of photos and bag every sunrise or sunset you can.
Oh, stop it.
Do not, underlined, spend a single second in sad reflection because I will know. And I will sail De Melza to the Antarctic and tit punch you there. Don't ever change. You don't need no man. Miss you already, Jen. I don't know what's funnier. Tit
Isn't
punch. Well, the idea of you sailing De Melza all the way there.
I thought that was brilliant. Have you got a single saucy tear? Yes.
Some sort of sad farewell music.
At the end of our ship quarantine period, we all boarded a double-decker bus, which was quite exciting because I hadn't really met any of these people apart from shoving a swab up their nostril. And I was really excited to get on a bus and, you know, have a good chat with people. And I boarded this bus, having not really seen life for 2 weeks. No one said anything. There was complete silence.
Do you think that was people being nervous or people being excited or not really knowing?
Well,
weird being out of the hotel room, I guess, after 14 days solid being locked up.
Yeah, and I think also for these people, they're employed to do a job and for 2 weeks they hadn't been doing it. And I suppose it was the same for me, but I got to swab people's nostrils. It was weird, but I kind of got it.
Yeah.
So I sat right at the back of the bus because I thought I'll be a rebel one last time. And a really nice chap called George, who was the third mate, came and sat next to me. And I just thought, do you know what, Rach, you've just got to go for it. So I started talking to him and the entire journey he filled with, oh, and when you're on the ship, do this. And when you're on the ship, do this. And it was just wonderful. And he gave me a bit of a heads up of etiquette on the ship. So little things like, so you'll have a curtain and a drawer. Pull the curtain across if you're inside and you don't want to be bothered. But you can be bothered. Close the door if you don't want to be bothered at all.
It's all these funny little, like, etiquette things.
Interesting.
Interesting. Mm.
The ship contains some of the UK's most advanced facilities for oceanographic research in the polar regions.
So the James Clark Ross, this was her 30th year of service, having been owned by Bass for the entirety.
Built in the UK and launched by Her Majesty the Queen in 1990.
Single owner, one very careful single owner.
Albeit with a few issues.
Mostly. The other really cool thing about this ship was the captain who took us south. He'd been on that ship since she was first launched. She is this ginormous, big red ship. Beautiful to look at. Bright red hull. Mostly so you can see her in the ice. And at sea, she's got this massive, big white middle to her and then this little yellow top, which tells you that she's an Antarctic research ship. Her decks are teak. She's 99 metres long and she sits under the water at 6.3 metres. That's an important number, Jen, because it means you can get in and out of the Falkland Islands, Stanley Harbour.
Oh.
Yeah.
So I've been on the ship for 4 days now, and I've spent most of my time trying to sort out the hospital. So it is chock-a-block with kit to unload, kit to sort through. I can barely move for stuff, so I'm just sorting through all of the cupboards. We
boarded the ship, and we had about a week to get everything ship-shape, excuse the pun, ready for our long trip south and for the FIDS to join.
It's very fit for purpose. It's been a great scientific platform for BASS, and huge amounts of information about where the world is now have been gained from the JCR.
So this is my surgical instruments cupboard.
But the surgery looks like something out of the 1960s.
It might be up here. You can perform small operations here. This is a kidney dish.
It is absurd. It's got kitchen units in, got some chairs which are sort of nailed to the floor.
There's a whole heap of stuff.
It's actually quite cluttered because obviously lots of people have gone down there going, oh, and another thing, Rodney, I'll just put this in. And when you're in it, when it's flat and parked up, you think, oh, that's really good. You know, I'll be able to do tons in here. But that's an utter nonsense. You know, the seas can be less than smooth occasionally, and particularly Drake's Passage is well known for being a little bumpy. So actually, you can't do very much medicine, which is why some of the medevacs we've done recently are so extraordinary, because we have people who were super sick in a 1960s surgery, which is very beige.
There was a big study that came out in the 1970s that suggested that most of the common stuff that needed medical attention was actually accidents and not polar-related injuries. So cold-related injuries weren't really quite as common as accidents. And I think next on the list were things like headaches, lack of sleep, gastric problems. And the other thing they found was high rates of dental problems. I mean, it's well known in adventure medicine and expedition medicine that your diet changes quite a lot. You drink a lot more fizzy drinks, a lot more sugar, and you're living a different lifestyle. So your ability to regularly clean your teeth sort of diminishes.
Through all that stuff. I've got my overalls, so I feel like I'm part of the ship already. So I've got a bit more of this to do, and then it's smoko, so coffee break for everyone. Then a bit more sorting.
It's 6 o'clock on Thursday, November the 5th. Good morning.
The headlines this morning: Joe Biden has said he's on course to take the White House from Donald Trump. England has entered its second national lockdown, but also in today's programme.
Antarctica is Earth's one virus-free continent. To keep it that way, the British Antarctic Survey is sending a ship to exchange staff and resupply their bases for another year.
Eventually, the time came to leave. Now, in my mind, the last ever voyage of the James Clark Ross, with the captain's last ever journey before he retires, where there'd be a fanfare, the mayor would be there, there'd be trumpets, there'd be banners, there'd be people crying, probably drinking champagne. Unfortunately, because of COVID times, the only person that was there was the security man. But he did wave.
It'll take 7 weeks for the RRS James Clark Ross to complete the special journey departing from Harwich today. We can talk now to Professor Dame Jane Francis, who's director of the British Antarctic Survey. Good morning.
Good morning, Martha. It's been over 10 months of very, very difficult planning to try and understand how we can get to Antarctica safely so that none of us...
It felt like a long time coming because we'd spent 2 weeks in quarantine. We spent a week getting to know the ship. We'd had 24 hours of these very excited people coming on board. And then eventually the ship gracefully just glided off the mooring, and it went very, very slowly because it's got these beautiful bow and stern thrusters, and it sort of kissed its way away from the pontoon. I'm doing it with my hands. Can you see them? And we started to glide our way out of Harwich towards Felixstowe. Part of me was feeling pretty sad that no one had come along to say goodbye to this beautiful ship on our last voyage. Also that no one had come to say goodbye to me. Would have been nice, Jen. But unfortunately, COVID was in full swing at the time, and I think my parents had said they were worried they were going to get arrested if they came down to Harwich. So I'm glad they didn't come. But as we went out here, but at the end of the quay in Harwich, there was about maybe 200 people all waving and taking lots of pictures. And the weather couldn't have been any more perfect. It was one of those crisp, clear days. The water was glassy, the sun was beaming down, there wasn't a cloud in the sky. And we glided off into the ocean.
Must have been quite emotional.
I could feel how proud the captain was, so I did pop up to the bridge and the captain was just stood there with his arms behind his back, looking proud as punch. I feel a bit emotional now, Jen.
Rachel, best of luck. You're going to have the best time.
We're very lucky to have you, Rachel, and we, as with all of our docs, we invest a lot in you and we invest a lot of trust in you, so we wouldn't let you go down there if we weren't happy for you to have the keys.
That drive, that tenacity, that resilience, that challenge to face something that not many people do, and that interest in trying to understand yourself and how you're going to react to things.
Just go and enjoy it and enjoy the privilege of what it is, and it will give you stories to dine out on for the rest of your life.
The Coldest Shift is presented by Dr. Rachel Varnum and Dr. Jenna Plank. The series is produced by Rachel Varnum and John Wakefield. The executive producers are Claire Broughton and Laura Varnum. The studio engineer was Alex O'Donovan. With thanks to Falkland Island Television for their kind permission to use their report on the JCR. Visit them at fitv.co.fk. Thanks too to Arone Dyer for organising the use of her drone choir in this podcast, and to People Festival and Michelle Berger Music for enabling its documentation. Thanks as well to Brassland Projects Duchamp Inc. for encouraging the use of the piece. For more information, visit aronedyer.com, brassland.org and michellebergermusic.com. With thanks to the British Antarctic Survey and the British Antarctic Survey Medical Unit. Find out more about their crucial work at bas.ac.uk.
I chose Stick of the Dump by Clive King.
I've chosen Little Women by Louisa May Alcott.
I have chosen the book When Hitler Stole Pink Rabbit.
I have chosen My Friend Flicker.
Danny, Champion of the World.
The Seven Crystal Balls.
The Iron Man.
Claudine at St. Clair's.
The Guinness Book of Records.
I chose Ballet Shoes.
And then I came across in the school library a copy of Treasure Island. I was terrified.
I'm Janet Ellis, and each week I invite a guest to come and chat with me about their favourite childhood book. They often bring along their own battered copy.
It's not at all as I remember it.
This is a celebration of reading.
I ended up reading it to my mum at home every night.
Because who doesn't still secretly check under the bed for monsters?
I knew that it was true.
Harbour secret desires to run off to the circus.
Riding like the wind into the Purple Hills. It really captured my imagination.
Twice Upon a Time. Follow us on Instagram at Twice Upon Pod for updates and guest news.
I want to read this book again and again and again and again and again.
Twice Upon a Time is a Hat Trick podcast.